What's the issue? Sammy took in a breath, exhaled, and stepped back to the computer. They're using what I can best describe as a kind of rolling code, or something similar. Every time I think I'm remotely close to figuring out how they're encrypting their signals, everything changes, she explained. Suddenly, the frequencies and data they were sending are all altered, so I can't track down what anything means anymore. You're saying it's impossible to figure out what they're saying? Kate asked. Impossible? No. It can be hacked. But not in 3 days. Kate considered it. Understanding the variant communication signals once again might give them some leverage. If they were lucky, maybe Sammy could figure it out earlier than she estimated. They might be able to get a read on how many beasts were headed their way. But she did not want to rely on luck. Not with the future of the Allied States at risk. You're positive you can't solve it in 3 days? Kate asked. Positive as a proton, Sammy said, cracking a quick grin. Okay, probably not as funny given the circumstances. Basically, we're screwed. I don't know about that, Kate said, starting to pace behind the computer station. There must be something else we can do. I'm telling you, there's not a damn thing I can do to decrypt these messages any faster. It's like creating a vaccine for a virus in a week instead of a year. I understand, Kate said. She stepped away to think. Sammy was right that they wouldn't be decoding messages anytime soon, and the new gods had seemingly weaponized the organic network against the Allied States. But that did not mean there weren't other options to use the network against them. Perhaps there was something they could do to disrupt the upcoming attack, and better yet, prevent the new gods from ever using the webbing again. Sammy, Ron, pull Leslie out of there, Kate said. I've got an idea. A few moments later, Leslie was detached from the microarray connections and webbing. She rubbed the back of her neck where the webbing had been removed, wincing. You okay? Kate asked.
Yes, I think so, Leslie replied.
Good. Everyone, gather around. Kate waited for her team before starting in on her idea. Unless anyone has an idea, I think trying to intercept messages from the webbing network is a waste of time. Ringgold wants us back in Galveston.
So, everything we've done, it's been for nothing? Leslie asked.
No, Kate said. We stopped plenty of attacks when we first figured this out. We bought time for outposts that were able to evacuate, and most importantly, we found intel that helped us identify our enemy.
True, Sammy said. And with all our work behind the scenes, I was able to run some image analysis programs. I can say with an 80% certainty that Prophet Azrael in the video was Charles Morgan. Everything he said matches exactly what Ron guessed.
80% certainly isn't good enough, Kate said. But if we're assuming we know who this guy is thanks to that video, we have a better sense of our enemy. It seems like a man who might think he was wronged by our government, by our science, and who feels like he is truly delivering the future of mankind to us in the form of chimeras.
Basically a huge fucking asshole, Sammy said.
I won't argue with you about that, Kate said. But we know he's intelligent. He understands a variety of technologies and isn't afraid to use them to his own benefit.
He's an evil, arrogant bastard, Leslie said.
Perhaps we can harness his arrogance, Kate said. Science is only good with the proper checks and balances. I always found that my best results came when I was working with people smarter than me, unafraid to tell me when I was wrong or when we should consider different experiments.
This guy is working with a bunch of monsters, Ron said. I wonder how many brains they've got behind their operations.
I have a feeling he doesn't like when people tell him he's wrong, Kate said. But he's not surrounded by idiots. We can't forget about the masterminds and the chimeras, plus everyone connected to the network and those that helped build it.
I wish we could just burn it all down, Sammy said.
That's exactly what we're going to do. Kate looked at the webbing around the tunnel.
We don't need the army. That throne, the entire room, was covered in organic webs. I would be willing to bet that even the webbing around Houston shares enough connections for those webs to transmit signals directly into that throne of his, whether it's in Los Alamos or somewhere entirely different. But we can't listen to anything coming from that throne room, though, Ron said.
I don't plan on listening to it anymore. I want to destroy it. Like killing a weed by destroying its roots. I want to poison the whole network.
With what? Sammy asked.
I could maybe come up with a computer virus that scrambles their signals or something, but that'll still take days, and will only work on those physical computers attached to their network.
We're not talking about computer work anymore, Kate said.
A mentor once told me that to destroy a monster, I would have to create one. And we're going to do that again.
You want to develop a new bioweapon? Ron said, bottom lip shaking.
Not exactly, Kate said.
The development work has already been done for us. We still have the concentrated weaponized anthrax from that grenade, right?
Yes, Leslie said.
More than enough to kill a quarter of the outpost here if we released it.
Good.
We can move our operations safely back to Galveston and culture more of the anthrax bacteria.
More?
We're talking about a weaponized pathogen. You want to use it against the new gods? Leslie asked.
Yes.
That's insane, Ron said. If we deployed it and the wind blows strong, it could infect our people. I know it's not contagious. It won't spread once it infects people, but it will still kill so many.
We won't be aerosolizing it, Kate said. I want to grow as much as we can in the next 2 days. The anthracis bacteria that causes anthrax is extremely easy to culture and divides rapidly. It won't take long. Then I want to aliquot boluses of the bacteria into syringes.
Inject the anthrax? Ron asked.
I get it, Sammy said. Instead of a digital computer virus, we're going to use a biological one.
You got it, Kate said. Only it's not a virus, it's a bacterium. We can selectively inject it into various webbing network sites our scouts and other outposts have uncovered. Those vines will die off as the bacteria spreads, and even better, they'll actually serve as living bioreactors for the anthrax bacteria, allowing the bacteria to spread up and down the network, slowly killing every connected piece of webbing.
It's like we're setting an unstoppable forest fire, Leslie said.
And if we spread out the injection, we can avoid any dead ends and ensure they can't prevent its spread before it's too late for them, Kate said.
Why not just bomb the network, or physically burn it for that matter? Ron asked.
We have no idea how widespread the network really is, Kate said. And we already know bombing is ineffective from the tactical nuclear weapons we previously deployed. While the tunnels help conceal the webbing network from the air, they don't do anything to shield them from microscopic bacteria traveling through the cells inside the webbing.
Any other questions?
Sammy raised her hand.
Are you going to teach me to help culture the bacteria too? I need to do something helpful.
You got it, Kate said.
By infecting the network, don't we also risk killing off everything attached to it, including every human and animal prisoner?
I'm afraid this is the only way, Kate said. Whether we win or lose the battle for Galveston, the bacteria will keep fighting, routing out any surviving masterminds, beasts, or hives attached to the webbing.
Kate stared at the tunnel, picturing the bacteria spreading like a wildfire with grim satisfaction.
It will be our last gift to the new gods.
Fitz basked in the warm sun at Seawolf Park on Pelican Island, an island situated across the water at the northern edge of Galveston. The USS Seawolf, a submarine from World War II, along with the destroyer escort, the USF Stewart, were dry docked there. Both had served as an open-air museum before the Great War of Extinction. Today, the site had transformed to allow for a memorial service for all the lives lost in the battle for Las Vegas. Men and women in uniform lined up, facing President Ringgold at a podium. As the wind whipped at her hair and pantsuit, soldiers stood around a few caskets sitting in a series of small wooden rowboats in the grass near Ringgold. Each casket had an Allied States flag draped over it.
Today we say goodbye to those who made the ultimate sacrifice, Ringgold said. Today we carry their memories and spirits into the crucial days ahead. Know that they are watching over us and fighting beside us, as determined as any of us to preserve the freedoms we have so valiantly fought for.
President Ringgold saluted when the soldiers positioned near the small boats moved them toward the concrete pier surrounding the park.
Another group of soldiers removed the flags from the caskets and began folding them. Fitz watched in reverence as they finished folding the flags, retreating as others placed the boats with their casket cargo into the gulf, setting each on fire, then pushing them to sea. A bugler played taps as the boats drifted out in flames. What remained of the caskets and the few bodies they had brought back from Vegas would find their final resting place at the bottom of the Gulf of Mexico. He felt tears forming over his eyes as he maintained his salute. He sensed the same despair in Rico and Dohai, who were next to him. How many times had they stood side by side to say goodbye to their brothers and sisters? They were all that remained of Team Ghost. He regretted that they had not even been able to bring Ace back to give the man the burial he deserved. The older man should not have even had to fight this war. He had been past retirement age for a special ops group like Ghost, but Ace had never shied from a fight or the calling to protect the country and people he loved. The bugler finished, and Fitz let out a sigh. Most of the people who had come to pay their respects dispersed. President Ringgold lingered for a moment, watching the fingers of smoke streaming away from the boats before following her cadre of Secret Service agents to a jeep. It drove away, accelerating back to the EOC to continue planning the outpost's defenses. Fitz, Rico, and Dohai joined up with Beckham, Horn, and Timothy, all of whom were moving back to downtown Galveston following the rest of the mourners. They walked in silence. Fitz found Rico's hand as they walked, squeezing it gently. Her touch brought him a swell of reassurance, even at this dark hour.
"We've lost so many," she said. "Mendez, Lincoln, and now Ace. It's never going to be the same, no matter what happens next."
Of course, there were also all of their comrades who had died in the first war, people like Tanaka, Jensen, Riley, Meg, Garcia. Fitz used to find strength in remembering them, but now it just made his heart ache. Beckham looked out at the Gulf of Mexico. "I've watched too many brothers and sisters give their lives for this country. Every time, it hurt worse than the variant acid that took my leg and arm."
"That's why we must win," Dohai said. "So their sacrifices weren't for nothing."
"You bet your sweet ass we'll win," Horn said, clapping the tracker's shoulder with a big hand.
"We better hurry then," Fitz said. "We're running out of time and ammunition."
"I don't need bullets," Dohai said. "My hatchet and knife are sharp enough."
"Guess we'll be making some homemade bombs and sharpening some swords," Horn said. "Just like when I was a teenager, except I can't get arrested for it."
They all laughed for a moment.
"Better than bullets and bombs. We have each other," Beckham said. "We're back together again, and we're still breathing, which means we still have a shot."
Beckham put an arm around Timothy. "So what's the plan?" Rico asked. "I mean, the brass has to be planning something together better than pipe bombs made by Horn." She gave Horn a side glance like he was nuts.
"Even if the science team is right, that the Prophet is actually in Los Alamos, we don't have the manpower right now to launch another major offensive," Beckham said. "Truth is, we're better off defending this place, where we already have our heels firmly planted."
"But you know how the old saying goes," Fitz said. "The best defense."
"Another mission like Vegas will mean there isn't anything left for our defense. I'm working with Commander Jacobs to coordinate a strong defense strategy, though."
"Have you consulted with Corin?" Dohai said.
"The Chimera?" Horn asked.
"Yeah," Dohai said. "He might be one of our best advantages. He knows the new gods intimately and has the predatory senses of the enemy. He can tell you how to conceal our men or find blind spots in our defenses we might not have realized."
"Corin has proven to be extremely reliable, and he really does want to do whatever he can to help," Fitz said.
"So you really trust him?" Horn said.
"Yes,"
Fitz and Dohai said simultaneously.
"He didn't screw us in Vegas," Rico said.
"Yeah, but morale matters," Beckham said. "What will people think if we drag out a Chimera to consult on our defenses?
It doesn't matter what they think, Fitz said. Corrin could be a godsend. Take advantage of him while we've got time.
Fitzy's right, Rico said. The guy helped save my life, and I think he had a soft spot for Ace. He's just as pissed as we are. Give him a chance to help. You won't regret it.
I'll consider it, Beckham said.
When people see Corrin walking around with a hero like you, they'll have to trust him, Fitz said.
He knew Beckham didn't like being called a hero, but that was the truth. His name had spread quickly through the country after the Great War, and he had become somewhat of a living legend. Now that they were in the face of imminent destruction, Fitz wanted Beckham to know it was no time to be humble.
I'll see what I can do, Beckham said. I don't want people any more scared than they already are. We can't look desperate by bringing Corrin out to help us.
Rico let out a sad sigh.
Truth is, we are desperate.
Amen, sister, Horn said. For now, I'm going to check on my girls, then to the hospital to see Ruckley. Want to make sure the docs are treating her right.
I'm supposed to grab some food with Tasha, Timothy said.
Then he looked up at Horn sheepishly.
If that's okay with you.
Long as you keep your paws to yourself, Horn said with a raised red eyebrow.
Big Horn, I've got a meeting with Jacobs in the afternoon, Beckham said. He's organizing all the new defenses and troops that we recalled from Houston, but I'll meet you in the hospital after I check in on Javier.
The group split up, with Dohai heading to check on Corrin, who they had left under guard. For the first time in what seemed like forever, Rico and Fitz were alone. It felt strange, but good at the same time. They continued walking along a sidewalk neighboring the port. Men and women were moving precious crates of ammunition to resupply points along the walls. Watchtowers and machine gun nests were bolstered with camouflage netting that not only concealed their positions, but helped protect somewhat against any possible bat attacks. In only a few hours, Fitz and Rico would be back in meetings, trying to come up with a game plan on how Team Ghost could best help defend the last true strongholds of the Allied States. Unlike Beckham and Horn, they didn't have any family to see in the meantime. All they had were each other.
I missed you, Jenny, Fitz said. I was worried sick about you when I was stuck in Canada.
Me too. But we're together now.
And it's going to stay that way.
Fitz stopped, took her hands in his own, and faced her.
No matter what happens, I'm never leaving your side again. We're in this thing until the end.
Until the end, Rico agreed.
Fitz pulled her into an embrace, kissing her in the middle of the street. He relished the warm touch of her lips on his, memorizing every feeling, every sensation flooding him. He did not know how many more opportunities like this they might have left. All he knew was he had to enjoy what they did have. Just the two of them, strolling together, accompanied by a salty breeze and a promise that maybe, just maybe, if they survived this, there would be more of these moments. Fitz held her close, her head pressed against his chest.
We're going to make it through all of this together. I promise.
19. Azrael entered what was once the world's most advanced and powerful linear accelerator, a monumental achievement in the field of particle physics. It was now the world's largest collection of heretics and traitors. Elijah walked beside him, fresh scars and wounds healing nicely. Puckered flesh from bullet holes were covered in reddened scabs and black stitches. Despite injuries that would debilitate, if not kill, a normal human, Elijah walked with a powerful gait.
You appear strong, but how do you feel? Azrael said.
Ready to fight again, Elijah said, head bowed. I hold the faith. Pain does not matter.
They paused just inside the linear accelerator where the loyal old Dr. Murphy waited for them. He bowed, his hunched back making it seem almost painful.
Prophet, I am ready to show you our newest creation.
Good. Take us.
Murphy turned, talking as they walked.
I would like to show you his strength in comparison to some of the scions we've made previously. I hope you will be pleased.
Murphy took them past a bevy of long metal tubes and wires, all covered in snaking red vines. Moans and anguished cries filled the concrete passage. A pungent mix of body odor, blood, and human waste hung on the humid air. He ignored the hands grasping at him for help. Cocooned human slaves hung along the walls and ceilings. With their success in Las Vegas, the new gods had clearly doubled the number of heretics serving their purgatory here.
"How many of these will join the Chosen?"
Azrael asked.
"We have enough VX-102 to administer to approximately 300 immediately," the old doctor said. "Many of them would be physically ready by the time we invade Galveston."
"Physically, but not mentally,"
Azrael clarified, stabbing a claw toward the fierce soldier. He paused by a man with veins bulging over his naked muscles. A crew cut crested his bloodied head. He directed hard eyes full of rage at Azrael. He was one of the recent arrivals, no doubt an experienced and well-trained soldier. The man screamed against the glue covering his mouth, his muscles straining and eyes bulging. The webbing snaking from his nostrils and mouth prevented him from uttering anything more than a guttural cough. Elijah bared his teeth, snarling at the man, who glared back as if he wanted to fight.
"I like this one," Azrael said. "He will serve me well. Start with him."
"Yes, Prophet," Murphy said. "It takes longer to break down the mind than the body, and this one will be a good test."
"You have continued to exceed my expectations, even in your frail body."
"I have worked with our scions and masterminds to ensure the proper amount of physical duress is applied, along with the constant deluge of promises of a better future for themselves and humanity if they chose to hold the faith," the doctor said. "I find this combination of physical discomfort and psychological assurances alters their mindset quickest."
"Excellent."
He strode past more new prisoners, clawed hands laced together behind his cape. These soldiers were all wonderful specimens to carry out the physical labor required to expand the new god's empire. Normal humans were not the only creatures imprisoned here.
"The sight of these animals makes me sick," Elijah said, spitting on the floor.
All along these walls were the mutated bodies of fallen scions. These were the rebellious ones, the ones that the mental reprogramming regimen hadn't quite worked on.
"None of these beasts have complied with even intense levels of reprogramming," Murphy said. "They retain a defiant nature that I have not been able to break."
"A shame," Azrael said. "We wasted precious VX-102 on their pathetic bodies."
"Still, they may serve some good, Prophet," Elijah said.
"Certainly," Azrael said. "They make for even better physical laborers than the humans. They're stronger, faster. We have ways of controlling them, even if they shirk the mental leashes we try to fasten around their minds."
"Yes, of course, Prophet," Elijah said. "I merely suggest that they may also make good practice prey for our elite scions. Human prisoners are too easy for us to hunt and dispatch. These ones may help us to better train our scion forces in the days ahead."
Azrael raised a clawed hand, and Eliza flinched. Instead of delivering a punishing blow, Azrael merely clapped the scion's shoulder.
"That's an excellent idea. This is one of the many reasons I gave you the General's position. A beast like the General or any other Alpha variant can only really think about their primal needs, killing and eating, but you, my blessed creation, are so much more than that."
"Thank you, Prophet. I live to serve."
The sudden sounds of screams and tearing flesh rose over the chorus of pained groans.
"What's going on?" Azrael asked. "Have you lost control of these beasts?"
Murphy wringed his knobby hands together.
"No, no, Prophet, I swear it."
Azrael picked up his pace past the rows of the fallen scions and human heretics.
his eyes locked onto a single scion standing in the middle of the pathway, his body covered in blood. Around his feet were the disemboweled corpses of three other scions. Elijah stepped defensively in front of Azrael. To Azrael's surprise, Murphy hurried ahead, reaching the scion whose back was turned to them.
"Stop," Murphy said.
The scion slapped the doctor to the side. Azrael growled and pushed Elijah out of the way. He strode out to meet this scion. The beast stood almost a foot taller than him, and thick muscles swelled under blood-soaked flesh. Healing surgical scars traced up and down naked flesh. Fangs protruded from his wormy lips.
"Do you know who I am?"
Azrael shouted in a crackling voice. Elijah hurried over to stand next to him.
"Recognize your master," Azrael screamed.
He grabbed the scion around his meaty throat. The scion resisted at first, but as soon as he locked eyes, the warrior stopped struggling. All aggression immediately evaporated, and Azrael loosened his grip. The scion dropped to one knee.
"Bravid, I am sorry."
Murphy stood and plucked sticky red vines off his white coat.
"Who is this?"
Azrael asked.
"My latest creation," Murphy replied. "The one we recovered from Mount Katahdin."
"What is your name?"
Azrael asked. Elijah snarled again at the other scion, still ready to strike.
"I have no name yet, Prophet," said the scion.
"What was your name?"
Azrael asked.
"Nick,"
the scion said.
"But that was another lifetime, before I was chosen."
"Nick,"
Azrael said. He disliked the plebeian way it clicked off his tongue. Such an uninspired name for a chosen scion with this power.
"Why have you killed these fallen?"
"Prophet, I told him to wait for us," Murphy said. "I told him,
silence. I did not ask you."
The scion gestured toward empty spaces along the wall where the fallen scions had been cocooned.
"They were speaking blasphemy."
"What do you mean?"
"I was watching the prisoners as Murphy asked, but they spoke ill of your name."
"What did they say?"
"I cannot repeat such heretical sayings. You will, and you will do it now,"
Azrael said.
"Unless you are one of the fallen."
The scion from Katahdin shook, not from fright, as far as Azrael could tell, but rage.
"They said that you would lead us all right to our deaths,"
the scion once called Nick said.
"That the bitch Ringgold would have us all killed, and you were an idiot to believe you could defeat them."
Azrael laughed.
"That's what they believed?"
The scion nodded.
"You heard nothing but the blathering of mindless idiots," Azrael said.
He turned to the doctor.
"Who were they?"
"These prisoners were former soldiers, guards from outposts in Florida.
They watched the fall of their outpost. They were chosen, given this treatment, and they still had hope of victory,"
Azrael asked.
"These heathens are better off dead."
He walked down the passage, eyeing the shredded flesh of the fallen scions, their white bone protruding from red muscle and congealed blood.
"You did all this by yourself?"
Azrael asked.
"I did."
"He's one of my best creations," Murphy said. "I had hoped he would restrain himself enough that you could see this display of power in person. We can prepare another batch of prisoners if you'd like."
Azrael looked at the remains of the fallen scions this beast had destroyed.
"That won't be necessary. I'm assigning him to my personal team."
Elijah seemed to rear back slightly. Perhaps he was jealous, or worried this new warrior would steal honor from him. That was good. Healthy competition among his ranks drove their strength and power. Azrael looked back to the new scion.
"Tell me who you were when you were a human."
"I was a father, a protector, a husband, until..."
"This family.
Where are they?
The scion shook again, golden eyes bulging from his head. His nostrils flared.
The man known as Beckham took them from me. He and a human traitor, a boy named Timothy, attacked my home. They called in an airstrike that slaughtered all the innocent men, women, and children the new gods so graciously sheltered in Mount Katahdin. Ah, Beckham. I know him well. But this Timothy, he's new to me.
Azrael stepped closer.
You want vengeance? You want retribution for what they did to you? Yes, Prophet. I understand. Look at me, Scion.
Their golden eyes met.
Forget your name. Remember your thirst for revenge. You are Abaddon, destroyer of heretics. Thank you, Prophet. Now let us find some prisoners to feast on,
Azrael said. Elijah and Abaddon marched with him back toward the human prisoners. Their eyes hungrily examined each writhing heretic.
Soon, you will be feasting on the flesh of your enemies and tasting the sweet blood pumping through their veins,
Azrael said.
Team Ghost, Kate Lovato, Jan Ringgold, and the most infamous heretic, Reed Beckham, will be our final victory.
Kate wiped the sweat off her forehead with the back of her hand. She had just finished unloading the last box of laboratory supplies from the transport truck into their new lab in the Galveston Hospital. Moving the laboratory from Houston to Galveston had taken her, Sammy, Leslie, and Ron the better part of the morning, but she knew it was necessary. The Allied States simply couldn't afford to keep defending Houston and Galveston. They had to consolidate their forces, and that included the science team. Leslie motioned to the boxes in the laboratory.
Kate, why don't you go see your family for lunch? We can take care of unloading everything and finishing the anthrax bacteria cultures.
I can help, Kate said.
I remember the last time I saw my daughter, Ron said, voice choking up. And my God, it wasn't enough. That was 8 years ago. And if I could go back, I would give anything to spend one extra day with her instead of spending so much time in the lab.
Kate, my whole family is in this lab right now, Sammy said. You all are the only ones I got left. And frankly, I've spent enough time with you three.
She gave Kate a grin.
But you have other people to see. Other people who need you, even if it's only for a moment.
Kate got the message. Her team was right. There was no way any of them could know what might happen tomorrow, but she could control what happened now.
Thanks. I hope you all know how much you mean to me, Kate said. I'll be back soon as I can.
Don't hurry too much, Sammy said, giving her a wink. Kate left the hospital and melted into the throngs of civilians and soldiers flooding through the streets of Galveston, finding new temporary shelters or carrying out orders to bolster the island's already formidable defenses. She hoped that all this extra effort was enough, because every single person she cared about in this world was on this little patch of Texas. In front of the apartment building where her family was sheltered, she saw Beckham was already outside with Javier at a table. Beside him was Horn and Jenny. Spark and Ginger were playing tug-of-war with a branch. Kate almost broke at the sight of what would have been a normal day back at their former home on Peaks Island. She halted to watch them from afar for a few seconds, remembering those days when safety was not an illusion. She took a mental snapshot of the scene to save for what would come tomorrow, when the enemies were barreling down on the walls and the horror of monsters returned. She would have this image to inspire her and keep her fighting.
Kate, Beckham said. He stood and waved her over. What are you doing here?
Turns out my team could handle things on their own for a bit, she replied.
Javier ran over and hugged her.
Second time in one day. This is great. I've got something to show you.
Oh, yeah?
Kate looked at Beckham suspiciously.
I was just telling Dad that I've been practicing some boxing moves Connor taught me, Javier said. I'm ready to fight some variants.
Kate pulled him close against her side with one arm. Normally, she would have scolded him. But today he needed confidence, and she had to admit it was good he was learning to defend himself. She waved at Connor, the Secret Service agent that had been protecting Javier and the girls. He was watching over them all now, and gave a friendly wave back.
"Where's Tasha?" Kate asked.
Jenny gave her a playful smile.
"She's with Timothy."
"They went for a walk together," Horn said. "Told him to stay within view of other humans."
"And you think they're going to listen to that?" Kate asked with a laugh. "Bighorn, I imagine you still remember when you were a teenager."
"God damn."
His words trailed off.
"Give them this time together," Beckham said. "They deserve it as much as anyone else."
"He's right," Kate said. "I'm just glad we're all still together. For better or worse, we're all one big family now."
"We're just missing Fitz and Rico," Beckham said.
"They're off on a walk, too," Horn said,
using his fingers to indicate quotation marks in the air.
"Days like this, I really wish Mom was here," Jenny said. "I can hardly remember her now."
"Oh, honey," Kate said. She went to the younger girl and gave her a hug. Horn sulked. He rarely spoke of Sheila anymore, but Kate could tell the big guy was thinking of her now.
"When this is all over, are we going to move back to Maine?" Javier asked.
Beckham and Kate exchanged a glance. Even if they were victorious, returning to Maine was probably not an option.
"What about a nice house along the Gulf? Somewhere we can enjoy the beach almost every day instead of just in the summer," Beckham asked. "I kinda like it here."
"The beaches in Mexico are better," Horn said. "But I can't speak Spanish worth shit except to order a cerveza, so Texas will have to do."
"Gingers like you don't do well in the sun," Kate said with a slight smile.
"I'll make sure he wears sunscreen," Jenny said.
That earned a few laughs from the group.
"Really? I like it here. And so do the dogs," Jenny said. "Tasha seems to like it too, when Timothy is around."
"Oh, we're not letting that young man stray too far ever again," Beckham said.
"No, we aren't," Horn agreed. "I'm keeping my eye on him, for more than one reason."
Kate spotted two more figures walking toward them. "Speaking of lovebirds..." Fitz and Rico waved as they crossed the streets and joined the group at the tables.
"Please help yourselves," Beckham said.
Jenny held out a plate of cut apples.
"Thanks," Fitz said. "Sure is a nice day."
"You always like the calm before the storm," Rico said.
She gave him a playful elbow in the ribs.
"But don't lie. You're just happy because you're with me again, aren't you, Fitzy?"
Horn laughed.
"You know, I'm pretty sure the guy used to hate it when you called him that."
"Oh, he still does," Rico said. "But he's learned to deal with it."
"Because deep down he actually likes it?" Kate asked.
"Nah, that isn't it," Fitz said. "I just realized Rico's too damn stubborn to ever stop doing something I dislike, and I use up all my energy fighting monsters to fight her on it."
"It only took him 8 years to learn that," Rico said with a laugh.
"At least he figured it out," Beckham said.
"Hey, where's Dohai?" Javier asked. "I wanted to show him some of my new moves."
The young boy kicked the air and chopped it with his hands.
"Nice," Fitz said. "But I'm afraid Dohai is looking after someone right now."
Kate had a feeling it was the captured Chimera Corrin. Ginger and Spark grew tired of the tug of war and trotted over to Jenny and Javier. Spark dropped the stick on the ground, and Javier picked up the slobbery toy.
"Gross, guys," Jenny said.
Javier threw the stick, and the dogs rushed after it, barking. Jenny laughed and ran after Spark and Ginger. They bounded over the grass, stumbling over each other in a desperate attempt to get at it first. Kate relished those moments. The conversation, playing with the dogs, and just being with those she loved more than anything, had been something she had missed desperately. It was just the break she needed from work, and a good reminder of why they were fighting so hard.
Part of her felt like she should be working. But now she was enjoying the moment with no idea if there was a future where she could enjoy time like this again with her family and friends. Besides, they had prepared as much as they could, and the kids needed something to look forward to. Some hope to cling to, when all else appeared dire.
20. An hour after lunch with the family, Beckham sat in a seat next to Horn in the cramped Galveston hospital room where Ruckley was being treated.
Damn, you look like the female version of Rocky Balboa after a debut with Variants, Horn muttered.
And you smell like a garbage can, Ruckley said, her voice coming out in nearly a croak. She cleared her throat. I keep having nightmares about ugly monsters. Then I wake and see something even worse. She looked at Beckham. Not you, Captain.
Horn laughed.
Us ugly people gotta stick together. That's why I came to see your mug.
You do smell, Beckham admitted.
You kidding? Horn asked. I showered. The girls made me do it, too. They said I was stinking up the whole shelter.
Ruckley smiled, but it turned to a grimace.
How are you feeling? Beckham asked. The doctors told us you'd been struggling when you first got back.
Exhausted now, but I've dealt with worse. I'll get out of this bed soon. I'm not going to let you guys go back out there without me.
Don't push yourself too hard, Beckham said.
Ruckley gave him a glance that flitted from his prosthetics to his face. He knew what she was thinking, but she respected him enough not to say anything. He held up his partially melted prosthetic hand with his other hand defensively.
All right, just don't do anything I wouldn't do.
Then he felt the smile fade, and he leaned in toward the hospital bed.
In seriousness, I also came to thank you.
For what?
You helped keep Timothy safe, Beckham said.
And he helped keep me safe.
He's a good kid.
Ruckley nodded.
He's a man now. Don't forget that.
You're right, Beckham said. Damn straight, Horn added, grinning. Anyone who goes into battle as many times as Timothy has is a real man, and a brave one at that.
His smile faded, and he patted the handrail alongside the bed.
You know, you scared the shit out of me. That's not an easy thing to do.
What do you mean?
Ruckley asked.
We've lost too many good people, Horn said.
Beckham heard an unusual slight crack in Horn's voice.
I was worried you were going to be one of them. And frankly,
he looked at Beckham, his freckled face turning a bright red. Realization set in, and Beckham held back a smile.
My God, Big Horn actually likes a woman, he thought.
Horn had never even laid eyes on the opposite sex over the past 8 years since he lost his wife during the fall to Fort Bragg, but Beckham had always encouraged him to find love again. That was the last thing he had expected to happen in the thick of the new war.
I was worried you weren't going to make it out,
Horn said after the long pause.
Don't worry, bub, Ruckley said. It's going to take more than a crumbling casino to kill me.
I'm just glad to see you back to your old self, Beckham said.
He started to stand, checking his watch.
I've got to talk to Commander Jacobs and Corrin. Big Horn, buddy, why don't you stay here?
Horn shrugged.
Yeah, keep me company, Ruckley said. Long as you don't get too close.
I really smell that bad?
Yeah, Beckham said with a grin.
Yeah, you do.
Hey, Captain, Ruckley said.
Beckham paused and turned toward her.
I promise, even if the doctors don't like it, I'm getting out of this bed to join the fight before they come, she said. I can't sit here while people die for me out there.
Beckham opened his mouth to speak, but Ruckley cut him off.
Don't try to convince me otherwise. I'd rather die in the battlefield defending this country than in a damn hospital bed.
With that, Beckham left the hospital and headed back out toward the street. Crowds of civilians walked in large clumps as soldiers ushered them to shelters. Many were new arrivals, people who had fled the fallen outposts, somehow managing to make it here with their lives. Beckham couldn't help thinking how many people were still out there in this country, fighting for survival like Ruckley and Timothy had. They deserved help just as much as anyone inside these walls. He shook the thoughts aside as he entered a former history museum that now served as Jacobs's headquarters on Galveston. Stairs took him down to a floor filled with what had once been expensive jewelry, ranging from near prehistoric times to the modern era. Beyond the glitter of the jewels and gold was another room, guarded by six men. Commander Jacobs stood outside of it talking to Dohai. Corin stood behind them, his hands shackled.
"You don't need to put this guy in cuffs," Dohai said. "He's not an animal." "We're taking a big risk parading him around already," Jacobs replied. "I trust you, but I trust those shackles more." "If Ace were here..." Dohai's voice trailed off as Beckham approached.
The burn scars across Jacobs's face glistened in the intense overhead lights.
"Captain Beckham, we're just about to begin our test," he said.
Beckham glanced at Corin. The Chimera was quiet, but he wore a scowl.
"Maybe Dohai's right," Beckham said. "The shackles might be too much. If we want this charade to seem real to the Chimera we have locked in here, we've got to treat him like the other beast," Jacob said.
He indicated the door to the vault, where the museum curators had once stored valuable artwork and historical artifacts. Jacobs's men now kept the Chimera prisoner that Beckham had captured outside of Houston. The plan was simple. They would lock Corin in the cell with the other beast, and Corin would hopefully get them some much-needed intel.
"Remember, we need confirmation of where the Prophet is. Any verification that the science team is right about Los Alamos," Beckham said to Corin. "If there's any intel we can get about that site or the new God's forces, it might be helpful to our cause."
Corin nodded.
"You backstab us, I will drive my own knife straight into your skull," Jacob said.
"And I would welcome it," Corin replied.
"Just get this over with," Dohai said.
Jacobs glared at the Chimera.
"Team Ghost speaks highly of you. I still can't decide if they're crazy, but I hope you prove them right."
Then he gestured at the guards.
"Take him away."
The six guards grabbed Corin roughly. He struggled against their grip, thrashing, as soon as one unlocked the prison cell. Jacobs beckoned Beckham and Dohai to a computer monitor set up nearby. The view on the monitor showed the concealed CCTV camera inside the cell where their prisoner Chimera was already chained to a wall. The guards secured Corin and his shackles next to the prisoner. One kicked Corin's gut for good measure, and Corin wheezed. Beckham didn't like it, and neither did Dohai. But he knew it would help sell the lie to the other Chimera that Corin was loyal to the new gods. The guards left and locked the door. For a few minutes, Corin huffed, catching his breath. The other Chimera stared at him.
"Heretics," Corin hissed, his voice crackling over the computer's speakers. "Vile creatures," the other Chimera agreed. "How did they catch you?" "A scouting party." "The Prophet sent others?" "Yes. After your team went silent," Corin said. "He sent us to find out what happened. Evidently, like you, we failed."
The other Chimera let out a low roar.
"These heretics will pay. The Prophet knows that we're here, and he knows that the President is here. He'll help us seek revenge." "The Allied States President is here," the Chimera said, all but confirming to Beckham that this was a recent revelation to the new gods. "Yes."
Even through the computer monitor, Beckham could see the enemy Chimera salivating.
"When I break from these chains, I will slaughter the filthy heretics," he said, snarling. "We must first find a way to break the chains, but we would be wise to be careful." "Yes. I overheard them talking about the Prophet and Los Alamos. They know more than we thought. Perhaps it's best for us to find a way to free ourselves, then take the head of the President back with us on our own."
The enemy prisoner tilted its own misshapen, scarred head. This was their chance to find the true location of the new gods, and if Corrin had blown it, then they would gain nothing from this chimera.
Los Alamos,
the chimera said quietly. Corrin nodded.
You're right. If we can kill her and return to the Prophet with such good news, we will be rewarded with all the flesh we can eat.
Jacobs looked at Beckham.
Maybe this chimera of yours isn't so bad after all.
Elijah told me if I returned to him with the head of any member of Team Ghost or the generals here, I would be made a member of the council,
Corrin said, reciting a lie he had prepared before.
Elijah said that to you?
The chimera sounded eager.
He made me similar promises. I was supposed to try and bring my trophies back alive.
Alive? Why? Corrin asked.
To serve us. And if they don't do it willingly, they can join the ranks of the slaves and the fallen.
At Commander Jacobs's command, one of the guards rapped on the cell door.
Shut your mouths before I crush your faces in.
The theatrics seemed to help convince the chimera he was talking to a fellow prisoner.
The Prophet wants Reed Beckham and his family more than any of the others,
the enemy whispered. Beckham froze.
That son of a fucking bitch, he whispered.
I do not know what the Prophet wants with them, but it should be beautiful,
the chimera said, nostrils flaring. The conversation continued until Beckham and Dohai were satisfied. Now he had questions. He nodded, and Jacobs ordered the guards to intervene. Two of them opened the cell door, and one slammed the stock of his rifle against the enemy chimera's mouth. The other kicked Corrin back. A group of four more soldiers in riot gear rushed in to restrain him and make it look even more realistic.
You're going to your own separate cell, you piece of shit, one of them yelled. After I beat the hell out of you.
The cell door slammed shut behind them, and the guards let go of Corrin. The chimera joined Jacobs and Beckham, wiping blood from his fresh wounds.
How did I do?
Corrin asked.
Well done, Beckham said. But I have a question. What exactly are these fallen?
I'm one of the fallen,
Corrin said.
Scions, chimeras, who haven't been brainwashed into their cult. We're the ones who they treat like slaves after they've turned us into these disgusting monsters.
And there are 100 in Los Alamos?
Dohai asked.
Sounds like it, Corrin said. I can't confirm because I was never at Los Alamos.
That chimera said there were hundreds of human prisoners, too,
Jacob said.
I'm not surprised. We had plenty of prisoners in Seattle. Most eventually became food.
Beckham tried not to picture his family, but he couldn't help but imagine them as slaves. They had to do something to help these people, and maybe...
What are you thinking, Captain? Jacob said.
Nothing good. But this is giving me an idea. Something that could give us an advantage if we get the right people to carry it out.
Like us?
Dohai asked.
Ghost? Like Team Ghost, Beckham said.
He turned to their chimera ally. And Corrin. Ringgold watched the sun rise over the Gulf of Mexico with Chief of Staff Soprano walking beside her. The view might have been partially blocked by the tall watchtowers overlooking the beach and the rows of razor wire gracing the tops of walls and fences, but she tried to find beauty in the hues of orange and red bleeding over the horizon. This might be her last sunrise as the President of the Allied States. It might be the last sunrise over what remained of the free people of the Allied States. Tomorrow morning was the deadline for her to submit to Azrael and his land of the new gods. Today would be filled with preparations for that fateful moment, when the forces of that monster descended on her to try and take what little they had left. A group of Secret Service agents shadowed her as she and Soprano walked down the street. She headed toward a pier that had been built along the shore. A half-dozen sailing ships and yachts were docked there. Some had already launched to sea, fleeing from the upcoming battle. But more had showed up to help the fight. Seeing other citizens enter the call to action filled her with confidence. Two of the agents walked ahead onto the pier, then ducked into a 40-foot yacht.
Once a luxury vessel, the military had since requisitioned it to transport troops and refugees. It had most recently found its way here from the Florida Keys after transporting nearly 50 people to Galveston.
All clear, ma'am, one of the agents said as he returned to the top deck. They're all waiting for you below.
One of the agents helped Ringgold up onto the vessel as gentle waves rocked it. Soprano followed. They then went down into the belly of the sea craft where a long wooden table was surrounded by a few chairs bolted to the deck on one half and a plush booth bench on the other. At the table were General Cornelius, General Souza, L.N.O. Festa, Captain Beckham, Master Sergeant Fitzpatrick, and Dr. Kate Lovato. She drew strength from having these people join her in this boat today. They were advisors and confidants, each adept and skilled in their vocations. But they were also her friends, the closest thing she had to family left in this world. They stood as she descended the last steps toward them.
Thank you all for being here this morning, she said. Please have a seat.
Soprano wedged his way into the cramped space to stand behind her. No matter what happens tomorrow, you have stood beside me through the worst times in American history, and I thank you from the bottom of my heart, she said. We've adapted and overcome challenges no one ever dreamed this country would face, and tomorrow might just be the strongest test yet. But I didn't call you here to spout a bunch of inspirational platitudes. She looked at everyone in turn, again soaking in the confidence she drew from their presence. You all have been actively involved in the defenses of the base, and while I trust our allies from Canada and Mexico to help in that matter, what we have to discuss here must stay classified, she continued. A few of you have presented ideas that may improve our odds tomorrow. I want to explore these opportunities and see how we can support them. Dr. Lovato, please give us an update on your mission.
Madam President, my team has isolated the strain of anthrax bacteria from the grenade the Chimera scouts brought to Outpost Houston, Kate said. We produced enough to seed the variant network with the bacteria. It's not a complex bioweapon, but it's effective. With it, if we choose our locations carefully, we estimate that we can infect over 90% of the variant network and any masterminds or other beasts attached to it.
I take it that infection won't completely destroy the network in time to stop tomorrow's attack, Ringgold said.
I'm afraid not. However, if our teams deploy the weapon in time, they can destroy small parts of the network as the bacteria continues to breed and kill the webbing.
Will that help us? Cornelius asked.
It will at least cut off the frontline forces from communicating with their base during the battle, Kate said. The destruction will likely continue well after tomorrow, too.
That sounds promising, Souza said. How many teams would you need to carry out this task?
Sammy was able to provide projections for us.
Kate unfurled a map over the table, pointing to locations around the Houston area and beyond.
Even if we stick close to base, we estimate that we can achieve 90% coverage via bacterial spread if we attack these 15 targets.
15 teams? Festa asked. That's a lot of manpower we don't have on our walls. Can we use less?
I don't think so, Kate said. But we can use small teams, maybe 3 people at most. Just enough to ensure that at least half the teams inject their samples so we can succeed. Using 15 small teams will ensure that even if one team is eliminated, we still have the other 14 target locations in play.
15 separate teams will also get the job done much faster than a handful of teams trying to travel between multiple targets, Souza said.
Exactly, Kate said. That means they can return to the walls as soon as they're done, well before the attack commences. I know it will be dangerous out there tonight. With the new gods preparing for a dawn attack, we don't know what our teams will face. But we've got to do this if we have any hopes of destroying their network.
Can we launch the injections earlier? Souza asked.
My lab techs are packing the bacteria and spores now into syringes that these teams can inject into the webbing sites we've identified. They'll be ready to go by tonight, so we can launch these missions before the attack on Galveston commences. That still gives our teams time to return to base.
Also, from what Kate tells me, this network may reach all the way out to Los Alamos, where they suspect the Prophet may be, Beckham said. Thanks to Corin, we confirmed that the Prophet's headquarters is there. This could very well kill him.
I don't see why we don't just bomb them, Souza said.
We have some bunker busters left. We have at best circumstantial evidence from the science team and the word from a single chimera, Cornelius said. You want to expend what little ordnance we have left on Los Alamos? If it will kill the Prophet, yes, Sousa said. We don't know that it will, Cornelius said. Los Alamos is an enormous facility. It's going to take more than a few bunker busters to completely wipe it out, and if we miss, he escapes. As much as I trust Dr. Lovato, our flyover of Los Alamos revealed nothing, Festa said. This might very well be a setup like Las Vegas. The Chimera scout could just as easily have been told to give false information after his capture. This Prophet is not a dumb strategist, Cornelius said. I do think he could conceal his location if he chose, so I'm not convinced Los Alamos doesn't contain a new god's facility. But, even if it does, what if this Prophet isn't actually in Los Alamos when we bomb it? We can't be sure he's there right now, and we have no way of knowing his current location.
That's true, as much as I hate to admit it, Kate said. Since we can't listen in on the network, there is no way to track him. If we bomb Los Alamos at the wrong time, when he's away from the base, then we'll lose him completely.
Not to mention the new god's claim to have control of the First Fleet, Cornelius said. He might be on the First Fleet for all we know. Either way, they've now got more formidable firepower, and we might very well need every last bit of airborne support and ordnance we have to fight against our own naval vessels.
Ringgold felt sick at the thought, but she knew Cornelius was right. There's one other thing that we haven't even discussed, she said. According to the intel from the prisoner Chimera, there are hundreds of our people imprisoned there, and I'm not going to kill them on a hunch that the Prophet is there. Sousa seemed to consider that.
Given the conversation, I suppose these bombs would be more impactful if the new gods forced our hand and we needed to use them on the First Fleet.
Agreed, Cornelia said.
Let's focus on using our remaining ordnance to defend Galveston first. Then, if we survive this battle, we can inventory what we have left and see if we can deploy it in an offensive move. But none of that really matters if we can't defend this island.
You're absolutely right, Ringgold said. Priority number one is keeping Galveston alive.
Madam President, I have an idea on how we can destroy Los Alamos without diverting too much of our defenses, Beckham said.
What's that? Ringgold asked.
I'm recommending Ghost launch an attack on Los Alamos while the new gods have their attention turned toward us. They won't see it coming.
We already decided we can't send an attack like last time, Sousa said. There's no way we can afford to send our best team to what could be a slaughter. We would need an army.
We have one, Beckham said.
Ringgold stared at the captain for a moment. Explain, Reed.
As President Ringgold mentioned, we know there are hundreds of human prisoners in Los Alamos, many of which I'd guess by now are probably soldiers captured in Las Vegas.
No surprise, Sousa said. They'll be feeding on them, I'm sure.
Yes, but they also use many for hard labor, Beckham said. Just like how the collaborators try to convert humans to work for them, the new gods have been culling our people for converts. They also perform experiments on them and turn them into chimeras, which takes time.
Like Corrin, Fitz confirmed. He was once a free man, but was held against his will when they turned him into a chimera.
Exactly like Corrin, Beckham said.
He turned toward Fitz.
You've seen Corrin in action. You trust him, right?
At this point, yes, I can say without any hesitation we can trust him.
There might be 100 more chimeras like Corrin who don't want to be a part of the new gods waiting in Los Alamos, Beckham said. They're dry tinder, waiting for a spark.
If they're half as hungry and loyal as Corrin is, then that'll be more than enough, Fitz said.
That's why I'm recommending sending Ghost with Corrin into Los Alamos,